Hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's presentation. My name is Martin Grant, and I am still the Dean of Science. Thank you. Please applause at the end. In the last 7 weeks, McGill scientists have addressed and explained the many areas of study and speculation that masquerade as science. Often research in these areas is characterized as bad science. We have learned about well-intentioned research into the paranormal, creationism, vaccinations, and climate change, and where that research can be incorrect and misleading to people. In an effort to debunk pseudoscience, this series has exposed the quacks and helped to dispel some of the scientific misconceptions. You can visit the website that's on the bottom of the screen there to check the answers to many of the questions we've had over the last few weeks. And I don't know when, but in not too far in the future, the lectures will be broadcast on Canal Savoie, and we'll put them on the website, the times at which they will be broadcast. And that's why we're taping these things. And my portions will be edited out to add enjoyment.
Can we do that now?
Yeah. It's sort of funny giving these things. It's the closest I feel like giving my classroom lectures for a long time, actually. Okay. And now, because this is science and we like to do things seriously here, I got a dirty look from my wife. We have a question. What are the differences and similarities between homeopathic and naturopathic medicine? Ariel knows because he's sitting in front. After six lectures, it's sad to see this. So,
homeopathy is based on almost infinite dilution of some agent down to the point of virtual invisibility.
Yeah, absolutely true.
It doesn't look at the source, it only looks at symptoms.
And I'll check our skill testing volunteer expert. Ariel, would that be the correct answer?
Very good, excellent.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. You were listening actually to both halves of the question. Naturopathy, Ariel, do you want to say?
No, naturopathy covers the whole field of different kinds of natural responses.
Naturopathy could cover all the form of alternative medicine, of which homeopathy is one. But homeopathy, in my mind, stays aside because it's totally nonsensical. But the other, maybe there's a little bit of sense.
Yeah, I knew if I paused long enough that many of the people in the audience would, of course, jump into the brink. At the end of tonight's lecture, I will ask you to write down your questions. And if we don't have time to answer them all, we'll put some of the questions on the website where Dr. Trache will give answers to them. In addition, please fill out the evaluation forms at the end of the lecture. Your mini science graduation certificates will be sent to you by mail. Please make sure your postal addresses are written on the back of the question and answer cards tonight and given to our volunteers as you leave. Okay. So tonight's lecture is as topical as yesterday's headlines. Are cell phones and Wi-Fi harmful to your health? Our very special guest speaker tonight is Lauren Trache, a governor emeritus at McGill University, who also earned 2 degrees, a B.Eng. in 1970 and an M.Eng. in 1973. In 2006, he was awarded an honorary doctorate by McGill. He is the co-founder of Matrox, a privately held group of companies that is internationally known for its innovative computer graphics, video, and imaging products. He is also an adjunct professor of the Department of Physics at McGill University. In 2003, Mr. Trache was awarded the Prix Lionel Boulay by the Quebec government, and in 2007, he was named a member of the Order of Canada. He serves on the board of the Montreal Science Centre, the Millennium Committee of the Planetary Society and a number of other organizations. His presentation tonight will discuss what I just said, how electromagnetic field radiation used by cell phones and other wireless technologies is dangerous or not dangerous to those around us. Okay, Lauren, you're on. Thank you.
Okay. Can everybody hear me back there? Is this microphone working? 1, 2, 3. Can we hear? Or do I need to use this one for now? Hear me there? Okay, so I'll just stick here for the time being. So we'll get on to the first slide. Are cell phones and Wi-Fi harmful to your health? That's the title of tonight's talk. And as Martin mentioned, this entire series has been about various areas of pseudoscience, and he went through the list of what the various topics have been. I've been to quite a few of those lectures myself, and in some of those talks, we heard a few stories about how practitioners of pseudoscience have been promoting their ideas to the public. And in the case of this topic tonight, those techniques are pretty much quite similar. There's a lot of misinformation on the internet, in the mass media. There's a number of highly vocal zealots, including a number of dissident scientists who don't subscribe to the mainstream views. And they've been very effective in getting their views across into the mass media. They also tend to use a lot of flawed and or discredited scientific studies or so-called studies to back up their claims. Now, I'm going to be presenting what is, I believe, to be the mainstream views. These results come from reputable, peer-reviewed scientific journals. The conclusions that I'm going to be presenting are accepted by the vast majority of the world's public health organizations, certainly in the industrialized countries. And as Martin mentioned, this talk is very timely, because the long-awaited Interphone study was released just this Monday. So my next slide here has a couple of interesting headlines. If that works there, you can see the Globe and Mail headline was, "Heavy Use of Cell Phones May Increase Tumor Risk Study." On the other hand, Nature, which is one of the most prestigious science journals in the world, their headline was, "No link found between mobile phones and cancer." We're both talking about the same study. I'll have a lot more to say about this later, but that gives a bit of a flavor of what this talk is about. There we go. Now, before we get going, I just want to define a technical term. Does this work? Still not? No? Hello? Is that working? Does that work? Okay. That gives me a little bit more freedom to move around. I'm going to define EMF briefly. EMF stands for electromagnetic fields. That's a little bit of a scary technical sounding term, but don't be afraid. Ordinary radio waves and just ordinary light are forms of EMF. Now, there are many different types of EMF, and I'll be going into that later in the talk and explaining it. But just keep in mind that cell phones and Wi-Fi also emit EMF, and that's what a lot of people seem to be worried about these days. Why did I take up this issue? I'm personally very passionate about science and technology, have been all my life. I'm interested in science education and outreach, also pretty passionate about combating pseudoscience. So a few years ago, Dr. Joe Schwartz, who many of you know, he gave the first talk and he organized this series. He knew me, he knows that I'm an electronics engineer. He was getting inquiries from people inquiring about this whole area of EMF and health and all that. I figured that me being an electronics engineer, I might be better qualified than him to look into it. Now, even though this is not my professional area of expertise, I have spent a lot of time doing research on this area, and I've read a lot of different scientific papers and studies on it. And we've set up a website, www.emfandhealth.com, that has a hell of a lot of information, some of which I'll be presenting here tonight. So a brief overview of what I'll be talking about. We're going to take a quick look at a few of the alarmist websites, types of things that they're claiming, a few of the scams that are out there. I will go into a little bit more detailed explanation of EMF, the various types of EMF. We'll also be looking at the scientific evidence. There's good science and there's bad science. And I'll be showing you examples of both. And finally, we'll come to a conclusion. So this slide here shows one of the alarmist websites. And this alarmist website is concerned about something they call dirty electricity. Now, what you might ask is dirty electricity. Well, in your home, everybody has electrical power outlets in their home. And I think everybody would know that the power you get from that is 120 volts, 60 cycles per second, right? So if you look at this chart here, the green stuff, that green thing, they don't show the whole thing, that's called a sine wave. Okay, and if you were to look at the electrical current on your wall using an instrument called an oscilloscope, that's what you would see. You would see that pure, nice little sine wave. However, there is a small amount of noise that's always present on your wiring, and the amount of noise can vary, and that's what they call dirty electricity. Now, the scale here is highly exaggerated because that's what they're trying to promote, that this is dangerous. This electrical noise is usually hundreds or thousands of times smaller than this big sine wave. But they're saying that this electrical noise causes all kinds of health problems with people. And they also sell products on this website that will help you reduce this dirty electricity. Okay. Now, here's another website that claims to be an objective source of information on health concerning EMF. And I'm just going to read a couple of quotes from the website. The purpose of this website is to uncover and communicate the facts concerning the electromagnetic radiation and our health. And they also publish an online magazine which claims, learn the practical and preventive methods to protect you and your family from its harmful effects. So again, this is a website that's promoting the idea that EMF is harmful, and at the same time they're selling products to help you feel better. There's also a community of scientists, a small minority of highly vocal scientists, who are also part of this whole group, let's call it. And this particular guy is he was a neurosurgeon from Australia. Here it says Britain, but he's actually from Australia, Dr. Vinny Kurana. And he published on his own website a so-called paper with the following title: Mobile phones could have health consequences far greater than asbestos and smoking. That's a pretty sensationalist headline. And guess what? It got him worldwide news coverage. I mean, that was picked up in the U.S., Canada, Europe, and he got himself on Larry King Live a couple of times with that. But anyway, we'll look at the real science in a little while. And of course, along with those two headlines I showed you at the beginning about the interphone study, there's been a lot of other things in the press. Recently, there was an article in Time magazine, How Safe is Your Cell Phone? This article tried to have some balance, but they interviewed one of these alarmist-type scientists. He made a number of unsubstantiated claims, which went unchallenged in the article, leaving people with reason for worry. Here's another headline from CanWest News, which publishes the Gazette here in Montreal and the National Post. This headline was about from a year ago or so, brain cancer linked to youngsters using cell phones. Again, based on some press release from one of these alarmist scientists, but not on any real substantial scientific data. As I mentioned, associated with those websites, there are some product scams out there. A lot of these people are selling stuff. And I picked up the following from actually a humorous post that somebody put up on eBay to try to sell some product. They're trying to make fun of these scams, but it's worth reading what they had to say. So, what you can't see could hurt you. Are EMFs hazardous to our health? Can electromagnetic fields from power lines, cell phones, home wiring, airport and military radar, substations, transformers, computers, and appliances cause, that's quite a list, okay, brain tumors, leukemia, birth defects, miscarriages, chronic fatigue, headaches, cataracts, heart problems, stress, nausea, chest pain, forgetfulness, cancer, and other health problems? Boy, did they leave anything out? Okay, but the reality here is that these are, if you look at what all these alarmists are claiming, that's what it adds up to. It's that pretty broad set of concerns. Now, this image came from that same humorous website, and this is a supposedly something that's going to protect you from the effects of EMF. It's pretty ridiculous. This one is a scam, but the next slide, that's a real product. This is a head net. Okay. And, you know, the ad says you can wear this whenever you go out, whenever you go for a walk, you go to work, even when you're sleeping. It protects your brain from the harmful effects of EMF. But it won't protect you from ridicule. So, anyway, this is just one example, but there are many products. As you go to our website, you'll see some of them, but they're selling everything from pendants, you know, like they wear a little pendant here, they claim it'll protect you, to filters for water. Drink this water, it sort of has special ions in it that supposedly protect you, and bed nets, you know, you're like mosquito nets, you put this net around your kid when he goes to sleep at night, protects it from EMF. Okay, now there's, as I mentioned earlier, most of the world's credible public health organizations have concluded that there is no good evidence linking EMF to cancer. And I put a quote here, which is from the SCENIHR. It's a scientific committee in Europe that works for the European Parliament. And their statement reads, "It is concluded from three independent lines of evidence, epidemiological, animal, and in vitro studies, that exposure to RF fields is unlikely to lead to increased cancer in humans." So that's typical of statements from various public health organizations. And in this slide, I'm showing you public health organizations that have made statements similar to the one I just read to you. The most prominent one is the World Health Organization. In the U.S., you have the American Cancer Society, the FDA, the National Cancer Institute. These are health organizations from Europe. And then you have health organizations, public health from Ireland, Japan, Australia, Hong Kong, Health Canada, New Zealand, Netherlands, the UK, and France. So pretty much, you know, all the major public health organizations agree with the statement that I just read to you. Now here I'm going to take some time to explain what EMF is and what the different forms of it are. So as I mentioned earlier, EMF stands for electromagnetic fields. This is just a technical name that applies to various forms of EMF, which include, you have it here, radio waves and ordinary light is part of the electromagnetic spectrum. You can see that this spectrum covers many different types of EMF, and the main thing that distinguishes the different types of EMF is the frequency. These frequencies span an enormous range of values. So at the low end on this particular chart, we have 10, which is 10 cycles per second, or 10 hertz. That's a very low frequency. And it goes all the way up here to where you have very hard, high-energy gamma rays. Those are at 10 to the 28, which is 10 followed by 28 zeros cycles per second. That's a huge number. It's a vast range of frequencies. Okay, now associated with each frequency is an inherent energy, which is that's an important concept to keep in mind here. It's what the quantum energy. So all EMF comes in the form of quantum units or photons, and photons have a characteristic energy that's directly related to the frequency. So at low frequencies, the energy of the photons is extremely tiny, and at high frequencies up in the gamma ray region, it's extremely energetic, extreme large amount of energy per photon. And why is that important? Because above a certain critical value of energy, these photons have enough energy to break molecular bonds. So they can cause damage to DNA, and radiation that's above this value is called ionizing radiation. So ionizing radiation is the only kind of EMF known to science that can cause cancer. So if you think of ultraviolet light, and if you go out into the sun, you spend too much time in the sun, sun has ultraviolet rays and give you skin cancer. X-rays, you know that that people say if you get too many chest x-rays or whatever, you're increasing your exposure, you increase your risk of getting cancer. So all these high-energy forms are potentially carcinogenic. Anything below that, according to science, is not carcinogenic. However, there's still some effects that occur with EMF at lower energies. So in the range here of radio waves and microwaves, okay, scientific measurements have determined that when there's enough power in those waves, which is not exactly the same as energy, but if there's enough power in it, that it will start to heat the tissues of your body. This is very basically the same effect as what you get in a microwave oven. If you turn on the power of a microwave oven, you're going to heat it up. So these kind of waves can heat the body. But the public health organizations have studied this in great detail, and they noted that if you limit the amount of power, the amount of heating you will get will be within safe limits. So your body temperature varies normally every day. From the time you get up during the day, whatever, there's a normal kind of rhythm. Body temperature fluctuates by something like a degree Fahrenheit throughout the day. And the heating effect you will get from using a cell phone or any of these devices is below that temperature variation, which is natural. And so because that's a natural temperature change, and our bodies are designed to withstand that and whatever, there's no harmful effects from that heating. At very low frequencies, like power lines, if you're exposed to extremely high power levels of low frequencies, another effect occurs where electrical currents or voltages are induced into your body, and you get a feeling like you're getting an electric shock. That's another type of effect. But again, that shocking effect or whatever is only present if you're in the presence of an extremely strong field. At the levels that we would normally be exposed to, that doesn't happen. So those are the different types of EMF. There's also infrared in there and so on, but you can see that the frequency is the important thing. The behavior of these waves and their effect on health varies greatly with the frequency and therefore the energy. And when the energy goes above a certain value, critical value, into the ionizing range, that's the only type that is known to cause cancer. Okay. Just go through that. I've pretty much gone through that, what I told you, so I won't spend time there. This slide shows the four main areas of concern that people talk about for the most part with regard to EMF. One is called electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or EHS, and I'll explain what that is a little bit later. It's another phenomenon people worry about are the mobile cell phone towers. These are the towers that are used to establish the connection when you make a phone call on your cell phone. A lot of people are worried about having these near their homes, whatever, they think that it might cause health effects. And of course, there's cell phones and Wi-Fi. So those are the four main areas of concern we'll be looking at. And then there's four kinds of studies that are done by scientists to analyze the effects of EMF. One is in vitro, where cell cultures are analyzed inside usually test tubes or whatever. And in these kinds of studies, cells are exposed to different levels of EMF. And then the scientists will study the cells after the exposures and see if there were any effects that occurred, any harm that occurred to those cells. Same basic idea with in vivo studies, which is studies with lab animals such as mice. Again, the mice would be exposed to different levels of EMF, and then the mice would be studied afterwards to see if there were any health effects. As far as studies done with people, these are epidemiological studies. There's two basic kinds of epidemiological studies, the case control and the cohort study. Now, the case control study, the interphone study was just released as a case control study. And this kind of study is one in which people are selected after they have a particular illness. So in this case, they selected people that had different types of brain cancer. And then they asked these people, they actually sent people to interview them with a questionnaire, and they were asked purely from memory, to try to recall how much they used their cell phones over the years. You know, how many phone calls did you make 1 year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? How long were your average phone calls? That sort of thing. And so a major problem with this type of study is what's called recall bias, which is a technical term for, you know, poor memory, bad recall. And the Interphone study has lots of problems with that, and they're quite candid about the problems they have with that. That's the main reason why, as we'll see soon, the Interphone study was inconclusive. A much more robust kind of study is called a cohort study. This is where people are identified, volunteers, if you will, before they have any disease, and their habits are followed during a number of years. So in this case, let's say they would be submitting their cell phone records to the researchers on a regular basis, so people would have access to actually how much they're using their cell phones over time. And also these people would grant access to their medical records. And so over a period of time, you'd see what illnesses they develop, and you would try to find out if there's a correlation between, you know, their behavior, like how much they're using their cell phones, and any illnesses. This type of study is considered much more robust and much more reliable by the scientific community, and there actually has been a major cohort study done on cell phones, which I'll describe later in the talk. So, alarmist sources. So alarmists and a minority of scientists point to a number of studies that appear to find effects that are harmful to health. However, the results of virtually all these studies have not been reproduced by subsequent studies. Serious errors in the reports that they like to bandy about, even fraud, have been discovered. And one of the interesting things here is that some of the alarmist groups, like the Bioinitiative group, which is, the Bioinitiative group, they published a major report a few years ago. It's the favorite report of all the alarmists. And that study basically was very selective. They only picked the studies that they liked, that had shown some potential problems, and they ignored all the much better, much more comprehensive studies that disprove their claims. So they're very selective in the data that they pick. Oh, I said virtually all the public health organizations, the industrialized countries, have published reports that affirm that there's no harmful effects from EMF. And I'll read one of those statements from the World Health Organization. Based on recent in-depth view of the scientific literature, the WHO concluded that current evidence does not confirm the existence of any health consequences from exposure to low-level EMF. And as I said earlier, most of the world's public health organizations concur with that conclusion. So here I'm going to look at some of the in vitro studies. So over the past 30 years, thousands of studies of the effects of the EMF on cell cultures have been done. And going to the ENIHR, whatever, from Europe again, they say that these in vitro studies have not produced any evidence that shows evidence for carcinogenicity, or causing cancer in living organisms. Right. Okay. And, further on the in vitro, to show you how some of these alarmist scientists misquote the data, I have a quote here from Dr. Martin Blank from Columbia University. And he made a statement not too long ago where he said, "We can state unequivocally that EMF can cause single and double-strand DNA damage." Now, if that were true, that would be cause for concern, because DNA damage is one of the things that can lead to cancer. But he based that statement, by the way, on a couple of studies, preliminary studies that had been published, but he neglected to state that there were a number of... Once those studies were published, it stimulated other scientists to see if they could reproduce those results. And they tried to do so, and they weren't able to reproduce those results. They found no DNA damage whatsoever. And furthermore, the main study that these guys rely on is showing evidence for DNA breakage. Was done by a guy by the name of Rudiger, and some people found that the data he had submitted in his paper looked to be cooked, and he's now being investigated for scientific misconduct, and his paper has been withdrawn. But these alarmists keep referring to those same papers that are discredited and ignoring the much better papers that occurred that showed no problem. So here I'm just going to briefly mention an example of a comprehensive, very rigorous study that was done here in Canada by Health Canada. It was published in 2007. What they did is they took three different cell lines, three different types of cells in vitro, and they subjected them to different levels of EMF. Low levels, medium levels, high levels, levels far in excess of what you would get from any cell phone. And they repeated each of these trials five times. They also, in addition to doing all these different levels of EMF, they also did trials where they had negative controls and positive controls. Negative controls, there was no EMF whatsoever. And the positive controls, they heated these cells to a level where they would start to react and show some activity, defensive activity. Furthermore, it was a very sensitive analysis because they used a very advanced technique where they could monitor the activity of 22,000 genes. There aren't very many more genes than that in the human genome. They monitored the activity of 22,000 genes in parallel. And the result of the study was that there was no change in the gene expression in any of the 22,000 genes in any of the three cell lines under any of the conditions except the positive control. So this very powerful experiment is a pretty strong indication that cell phone EMF essentially has no effect, let alone harmful effects on cells. That's what it suggests. Similarly, we come to in vivo studies where there studies have been done on lab animals like mice. And this bioinitiative report, which is the favorite report of the alarmist, again used selective reporting to talk about a study that had been in 1997 where somebody had detected that exposing mice to cell phone radiation increased tumor development, caused the tumors to be accelerated in their speed of development. But they neglected to mention that there were follow-on studies done a couple of years later that flatly contradict the results. That basically they looked for those effects and they found absolutely nothing. And the bioinitiative report completely ignored that. In addition to these reports that that rebutted directly what they did, there's been 35 other studies done on animal models that also came up negative. So the IEEE, which is an organization of electrical engineers, published a critique of the bioinitiative report, and they basically said that the absence of the review of a large number of longer-term animal studies that they neglected to include in their analysis basically indicates that they're highly biased and that they did not do a proper analysis of the scientific literature. So here I'm going to explain to you about EHS. This is another one of the broad categories that people claim causes health effects. And EHS, which stands for electromagnetic hypersensitivity, it's a grab bag of subjective symptoms. People complain that if they're in the presence of electrical fields or whatever, that they suffer from symptoms like chronic fatigue, depression, headaches, stress, nausea, dizziness, etc., etc. These are very subjective symptoms. There's no way you can measure them other than having people verbally say how they feel. These individuals have been studied in double-blind kind of tests. And a double-blind test, basically what happens is that these individuals will claim that they get sick if they're near a cell phone or a Wi-Fi network or whatever. They're tested where they're exposed to both real and sham radiation. Sham is that there's nothing turned on at all. But they don't know whether at any given moment whether it's on or it's off. And a researcher will, you know, allow them to sit there for a certain amount of time exposing to whatever it is, either on or off. Neither of them knows whether it's on or off. And they have to write down, okay, how are you feeling? Are you having any of these symptoms? But there's another experimenter in the back room who has a switch that turns this stuff on or off. And after these trials are over, then they compare the results, you know, how people felt in each of the trials, and was the ENF on or off. And the result of virtually all the double-blind studies is they're unable to detect the EMF. So, however, that hasn't stopped the alarmist community from continuing to pursue this. And here's a paper that was done by somebody from Canada, Dr. Magda Havas of Trent University in Ontario. And she's one of the most active EMF alarmists in Canada. And she actually recently testified on Parliament Hill in front of a number of parliamentary committee, saying that she thinks that this is a big problem. And let's see what her study is all about here. So Havas claimed that her hypothesis was that dirty electricity in a school was causing teachers and students to have these EHS symptoms. Okay, and she wanted to test the effectiveness of something called a Graham-Stetzer filter, which supposedly can reduce or clean this dirty electricity. It's one of the products that's sold on that website we saw earlier. And basically, what is it? It's a device that looks a bit like a power adapter or charger from your cell phone. And you plug that in, they claim it filters out the dirty electricity. Okay. So a problem with her study was that it was not double blind. So in other words, when she went into the classrooms and she gave questionnaires to teachers, she knew when real filters were in and when dummy filters were in. Also, there were twice as many real filters. On the days where the real filters were installed, there were twice as many of them as dummy filters. So any teacher who could count would know, you know, that there's a difference on this day versus that day. So that methodology right away is highly subject to error. And when we look at the results, this summarizes the results of those questionnaires. Are you hearing me?
No.
This summarizes the results of those questionnaires. And these charts are color-coded. So when teachers filled in their questionnaires, they filled in yellow means that they felt the same. Green means they felt better. Red means they felt worse. So we look at this chart for teachers. We can see that the overwhelming number of responses were yellow, which is same, which is about 80%. Okay? But if you look at the way Havas analyzed her statistics, and I won't bother to explain how she did it, because as Mark Twain once said, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. She claims here that 79% of the cases, teachers felt better, and in 13% of the cases, they felt worse. However, if we look at the students, we see the opposite, that, can't read it here. Only 30% felt better and 61% felt worse. So we look at her conclusions here. I summarized it in this chart. Her conclusion, the teachers were much better, but the students, there was no change. Okay. 6 inches? Okay. Sorry about that. So, you know, these are pretty skewed statistics. And furthermore, you know, the students actually ended up worse and the teachers actually felt better by her own analysis. But she ignored that. She just said the students, there was no change and the teachers were better. So I don't think we can believe this study. It's not really worth much of anything. The whole methodology is screwed up and her analysis of the data is all screwed up and her conclusions are all screwed up. All right, so just to summarize that again, she made a false assumption, first of all, that these devices do anything real, like removing dirty electricity, they don't really do anything. The study hypothesized that removing dirty electricity improves well-being. The study was poorly done, and the conclusions don't match the results. Okay. So here's an example of a study that was done which reviews the double-blind studies that I mentioned earlier. This particular paper was published, I think, in 2005,
It was a review of all of the double-blind studies on EHS that had been done up until that point. They scoured the literature. They tried to find every double-blind study that had been done. And they have found 31 of them. They analyzed them. And the results were that none of these studies showed that people could really detect real EHS. Here's another thing that was published in The Economist about a year ago, and it has to do with electrosensitive individuals who were tested inside of a brain scanner. And basically what they found is that when these people in this brain scanner were exposed to sham radiation, in other words, nothing real, but they believed that there was something real, that the pain centers of their brain actually lit up. So just to read a quote here, it said, when it came to the sham phone exposure, only the electrosensitives described any sensations which ranged from prickling to pain, and they showed the neural activity, in other words, in the brain scanner, to match. So the WHO has concluded that electrosensitivity could be a psychosomatic disorder. It's important to note that psychosomatic disorders are real, but in this case, the disorder may be real, but it is not caused by EMF. It's not caused by electromagnetic radiation. Okay. So now we're going to look at cell phone towers. And here, there was a documentary done on French television a couple of years ago on Radio-Canada, a program called Découverte. They had a segment on about Wi-Fi and cell phones and how it's dangerous to your health. And this particular program was very badly done. And they quoted a lot of the pseudoscience. And in this case, we'll just focus on what they had to say about cell phone towers. They highlighted two papers, and I'll take a brief look at one of them. This is a study that was done in Israel of people living near a cell phone tower. And they wanted to study the cancer incidence of people living near the tower versus people living further away. That sounds interesting. But they use a very absurd methodology, which I'll briefly describe. So this cell phone tower that they studied entered service in the year 1996. Okay, now 1 year later, they looked at the health records from these two areas close to the cell phone tower and further away. Just 1 year later, they found that near the cell phone tower there were 8 cancers, different types of cancer, all unrelated. Further away, there were just 2 kinds of cancer, 2 cases of cancer. So it seemed like there was a 4-to-1 ratio. But that's only 1 year after this cell tower entered service. That's pretty preposterous. They're going to make any conclusion from that because gestation for cancer is a lot longer than a year. Now, the other interesting thing that this tower entered service in 1996, they did this analysis in 1997. They looked at the data for 1997. But the paper was published in 2004. What about all the years between 1997 and 2004? They didn't say anything. This is just cherry-picking of data. As I summarize there, it's absurd. Okay, right. This is another paper, which was a scientific survey of papers that have been written about people living near different types of transmission towers, cell phone towers, as well as radio and television transmission towers, and they were looking for evidence of a disease or cancer for people living in those areas. They included radio and television transmitters because those have been around for a lot longer than cell phone towers. And by the way, they're much, much more powerful than any cell phone tower, up to 1,000 times more energy coming, or more power coming out of them. And their conclusion here was that overall weight of evidence shows that there's no causal association between cancer and exposure to these transmission towers. So that's one of the more important papers that has appeared on that topic. And the World Health Organization has published a whole monograph or fact sheet on this particular issue. And a couple of the major points from that, they said at the time they published that was a few years ago now, there were 1.4 million cellular base stations in the world at that time. And given the widespread, and they also said that studies over the past 15 years show no link between these towers and cancer. He said, you know, like the example of that Israeli one that I mentioned, just by pure coincidence, you may find that, you know, there's an increased incidence of cancer next to a particular cell tower for a particular year or whatever. But if you average it out over, you know, enough data to make it statistically significant, there's nothing there. They also noted in the same monograph that long-term studies on animal models, all, like the lab animals and so on, have also not shown any harmful effects. So, again, this European organization, they published this report last year. They said recent well-conducted epidemiological studies provide evidence against an association between RF, EMF, and broadcast transmitters and the risk of childhood leukemia, along with other cancers. Now, finally, we're coming to the area of cell phones, which is the area that's been in the news this week in particular. And I mentioned earlier the different types of studies that are done. So the case control study is the one where questionnaires are sent to people who already have an illness. And they're asked to remember how much they use their cell phones in the past. And such studies can suffer from recall bias. I'm just going to take a quick sip here. Clear my throat, sorry. Great. And the alarmists have their darling, his name is Dr. Leonard Hardell. He's a Swedish researcher who specializes in case control studies on cell phones. And all his case control studies seem to show a very high risk of developing brain cancer from using cell phones. But again, it's based on these questionnaires, which are highly suspect. And Hardell's findings have not been confirmed by other case control studies, such as Interphone, which is the one that was just released. And the American Cancer Society says that these types of studies have relied on people's memories for information about past cell phone usage, which may or may not be dependable. The same guy, Dr. Leonard Hardell, has a serious conflict of interest of his own. He also, along with doing this kind of research, he's also testified in a number of high-profile trials where brain cancer patients have been suing cell phone companies for damages. This particular case, the suit was for $800 million for one particular individual. And in this trial, the judge rejected his so-called expert testimony for lacking in scientific credibility. But this is the guy that's the main hero of the alarmist movement and his studies that are the ones that they cite the most. So here's an example of a cohort study. This is a study where people in Denmark was done with 420,000 users, cell phone users in Denmark. And in this case, they did get access to the cell phone records of those 400,000 users, as well as their medical records, going back as long as 21 years. Okay, so this is a very serious and objective study, which doesn't suffer from any of the recall bias problems. And the conclusion, they found absolutely no evidence of an association between tumor risk and cell phone use among either short-term or long-term users. Furthermore, because they had access to all the medical records, they could state with confidence that cell phones don't cause any illness whatsoever, never mind just cancer. Okay. Now we come to the Interphone study, which is the study that was just released this week. Kind of a coincidence. Now, the Interphone study was an international case control study that was done in 13 countries and was coordinated by the World Health Organization. And, of course, this case control study also suffers from the problem of recall bias. And the study authors, the Interphone study authors, like good, true scientists, analyze all their data and point out all of the inconsistencies and potential errors in their study. And that's, go back there. That's the main reason why they say that their results are inconclusive. So we come back to this contrasting headlines between the Globe and Mail and Nature. And here's the quote from the conclusion of the Interphone study, and I'll just read it for you. Overall, no increase in risk of cancer, I won't mention those technical terms, was observed in the use of cell phones. There were suggestions of an increased risk of a particular type of cancer in the highest exposure levels, but biases and error prevent a causal interpretation. The possible effects of long-term heavy use of mobile phones require further investigation. So I've read the full study myself, and I can just mention a couple of the inconsistencies that the authors themselves point out. So for about 90 to 95% of the cell phone users that they studied, again with this questionnaire technique, they actually found a decreased risk of cell cancer, of brain cancer, which doesn't make sense. And the authors freely admit that. Now, in a 5 to 10%, depending on how you look at the numbers, they found an increased risk. There's not much more reason to believe that portion of the study than the other part of the study. But within the small group that where they found this increased risk, there were a number of other further inconsistencies, again, due to the fact that all of that is based purely on memory, that just don't add up. So, for example, among the heavy users, the ones that had the highest risk were the ones that had been using their cell phones for the shortest period of time. The ones who had been using it for a longer period of time actually had a lower risk, although it was still higher than one. It was still lower than the short-term users. There was also, in the responses, they asked people, you know, how long you were using your cell phone, and quite a number of them, you know, said, well, 12 hours a day. Well, that doesn't seem very credible, and so on. Furthermore, another inconsistency which they found in there was that when they looked at people who had made the largest number of phone calls on their cell phones, there was no increased risk. Okay, so only people that had been making the longest duration calls for the shortest amount of time were the ones that had the highest risk. Doesn't make sense. So that's basically what they're saying here is that, just to read that quote over again, but biases and error prevent causal interpretation. That's basically what they're saying. So what other things can we say? I'll just try to go a little quicker here. What can we say about brain cancer? Well, here's a chart that comes from the Canadian Cancer Society. And on this chart, if you can see the little star there, that's brain cancer. This chart lists all of the major types of cancer in Canada. And brain cancer is number 15. So brain cancer is a relatively rare cancer. The number of cases of lung cancer or breast cancer is at least 10 times greater. Okay, so brain cancer is relatively rare. Now there's 22.8 million cell phones in Canada, and there are 2,600 new cases of brain cancer in Canada per year. Now, if you had even a 1 in 10,000 chance of developing brain cancer in any given year from using a cell phone, if that were to be the case, that would double the number of cases. You just do the simple arithmetic. It works out to 1 chance in 10,000 is 2,280 cases per year. That's roughly equal to the 2,600. Another observation, which also comes from the Canadian Cancer Society, is that over the last 10 years, the incidence of brain cancer, kind of the number of cases per year, has remained roughly constant. In fact, it's actually gone down slightly. So, again, that would argue against the idea that cell phones would cause brain cancer, because you'd expect to see an increase if there was such an association. These findings are echoed in many other countries. This particular chart comes from the northern countries of Europe, the Nordic countries, okay? And it shows, the different colors are different age groups. It shows the incidence of brain cancer starting from about 1970 going up to 2004. And cell phones entered use somewhere around here in 1985. And you can see that from 1985 to the present, there's been no change. There we go. The same finding has been confirmed in the United States. The U.S. National Cancer Institute put out a statement about a year ago where they said that the incidence of brain cancer in the United States had not changed from, in this case, 1987 to 2005. Yeah. This is just a restatement of what this chart is saying from the SC, the European organization there. And then there's also a study that was published in Denmark also looking at the incidence of cancer in Denmark, and it came to the same conclusion. So that's a pretty strong indication that there's nothing really happening. If cell phones were causing brain cancer, given the fact that brain cancer is a relatively rare cancer, it should show up in these statistics. It does not. Then we have here a couple of the major alarmist reports, this bioinitiative report, which I mentioned a few times in the course of the study. And there's a recent one that came out about 9 months ago. This one is basically directly attacking the Interphone study 6 to 9 months before it was released. They were already publishing something attacking its conclusions. I said both of these reports are actually authored by the same small group of dissident scientists. They're very selective in referencing only the studies that show the results that they're looking for, and they ignore the fact that all those studies have been refuted by much more rigorous and comprehensive studies. These are a couple of examples of reports from mainstream scientific organizations. The one on the left is from the World Health Organization, and the one on the right is the SCENIHR from Europe. That was a big report they released last year. And all of these reports are pretty consistent in saying that there's no convincing evidence of any health effects. Now, a lot of the alarmist groups cite what they call the precautionary principle. They say, well, you know, we don't have to be, we should be taking precautions even if we're not really sure. Now, the initial statement of the precautionary principle actually came out in 1992 at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. It was made at a time when evidence for climate change first became fairly well accepted in the scientific community. And, you know, basically they were saying things like, where there are threats of serious and irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason not to do anything. Okay. But in that case, there was evidence that climate change is real. Where the uncertainty was, and there's still some uncertainty today, is how quickly and how severe it will be, and, you know, what the economic costs will be. But there's no doubt that climate change is happening. So that's unlike the evidence for EMF and health, where there is no good evidence that EMF does anything, including cause health problems. So in conclusion, science cannot prove a negative. Individuals and all these public health issues say, if you feel nervous, you can take precautions if you want. Don't use your cell phone or various other ways of doing it, but that's up to you. But all the mainstream scientists agree that there's no real evidence for harm. They all say, well, we can, because we can't really prove a negative, there's always room for more studies. But so far, we haven't found anything. And if you want a lot more information where that came from, go to our website. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. And now we have the portion of our presentation devoted to skill testing questions and to my ability to read your handwriting. And I ask again if your questions could be written as legibly as possible. And while I'm waiting for our skilled volunteers to pick up and sort our questions, I have a wonderful parting gift for Lauren.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the people who have made this series possible. My job, as you appreciate, after 7 weeks, is to be the goofy front man, but I really don't do anything except show up here with my wife at 20 after 6 and read what has been prepared for me. The real work has been done by a number of people. I'd like to recognize a couple of them right now. Ingrid Berker, who's standing right there. Catherine Peterson, who's hiding at the back of the room. I'd like to recognize the leadership of Cappy Flanders, who started the mini-series at McGill with Mini-Med, now culminating with the greatest of the mini-series of mini-science. No, never mind. And now we have the portion of our presentation. Well, I guess I'll wait a second. I'll see if I can... oh, here we go. Where we have skill testing questions for Lauren. And I think Lauren well embodies that if you have questions about something about science, it's not a mystery. Science is about being convinced. If you're not convinced about something, look it up yourself. The scientific literature is open to everybody, and scientists would like nothing more than to talk to people what they do for work. And we start with someone who did not pay attention to the dean's admonishment of good handwriting is number one. But it's kind of a deep question, actually. It was one of my questions, but fortunately I have a couple left over. Because there's always something like every couple of years it's bad that you hear about, and you're never sure if it's really bad or not. And, Lauren, did TV raise the same anxiety as cell phones and things like that many years ago?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think what people were generally concerned about with regard to televisions and the old kind of big tube screens that people used to put in front of their computers was that were these TVs or screens.
You got to go here.
Okay, sir. Okay. So what people were concerned about a number of years ago were the TV screens themselves giving out harmful radiation. In the case of the old-fashioned tube TVs, okay, those TVs have very high voltages in them, and they use an electron beam to scan the picture on the tube, and those electron beams are accelerated inside the CRT, it's called cathode ray tube, to scan that picture. And when electrons are accelerated and they hit something, they can emit X-rays, and X-rays can be harmful. But those TVs were all subject also to safety regulations, and the amount of X-rays, the type of X-rays they emitted were very soft X-rays and very weak, and the level would drop off, you know, within a few inches, a couple of inches from the screen. So unless you stuck your nose right in front of the TV and you kept it there all day, you know, you're not going to be exposed to anything that would be considered dangerous.
Okay. Here's a cool and very beautiful handwriting on this one, which brought it to the top of my pack. And it's an interesting question, actually. Given the fact that we are electrical beings, sort of like I sing the body electric here, do we ourselves emit an electromagnetic field?
Well, Martin, you're a physicist. You would know the answer to that. That's right. Yes, we do. The human body does emit an electromagnetic field. It's very weak. It's very low level. But, Michael Faraday established, you know, back in the 1830s when he did the first experiments with electricity and magnetism, that electricity and magnetism and electric fields are interrelated. And whenever you have one, you always have the other.
Okay, and here's someone who heard you today on the radio. And this person's question is regarding the anecdotal evidence by the nurse, person who said she is a nurse at the Children's, and she said there was an increase in the number of kids with brain cancer. Can you give more information?
Well, I can repeat more what I said on the air, and if you don't think that's enough, well, challenge me. I'll see if I can think of anything else. But first of all, there haven't been studies that have been specifically done on children yet in the literature, so it's hard to say exactly, but you know, there's a couple of major points that I covered in my talk here that would indicate that there's really not much ground for concern. The first is the data from people like the Canadian Cancer Society and the other cancer registries in the world. The Canadian Cancer Society, along with their equivalent agencies in the United States and Europe, compile cancer statistics every year, and they publish full reports of that, and they are analyzing the data constantly looking for a change in incidence of cancer. Any change is immediately flagged and immediately the grounds for investigation. And so no change in the incidence of this type of cancer has been found in any of the age groups, including children. So that would be an indication that there's not much ground for concern, although we can't predict for sure, 100%, like science can't prove a negative, that something might not show up later on. And the other line of evidence is what I mentioned about the animal studies and the test tube studies and so on. And as far as carcinogens in humans are concerned, all of the carcinogens that are known to cause cancer in humans also cause damage or cancer in lab animals and in cell cultures. There are no known carcinogens that do not produce some measurable effect, either in cells, cultures, or in animals. And so far, there's no credible evidence of any effect whatsoever, let alone cancer, in there. Although the alarmists have their studies where they claim the opposite, but as I mentioned earlier, rigorous, comprehensive studies don't show any cause for concern there. So that would indicate that it would be less unlikely to suddenly show up just in children.
Here's a question which someone has asked, presumably because they know I'm a university administrator, and it's for you to answer, though, not me. So after this woman's study about, I don't know if she's doing line conditioners or power filters or whatever, Dr. Havas, what is she doing now? Like, is she selling seashells by the seashore? Or you took it apart pretty well, but what does she do now?
Well, as far as I know, I believe she's still a professor at Kent University in Ontario. And just last month, she was up on Parliament Hill testifying in front of a group of MPs trying to, get people worried about EMF and health and trying to get the government to take some restrictive actions. Now, people like her have had quite a bit of success in Europe, where in Europe the public has been aroused by a lot of these alarmists, and the European Parliament actually passed a motion last year asking their scientists to go and look again at the data and come back with some new recommendations. And this was kind of ridiculous in a way because their scientists had just published a report like 2 months before, the report that I kept referring to in this talk, where they say that there's no evidence for any harm. They said, well, we're not satisfied. Go back and look some more. But anyway, so that's what Havas is trying to do. She's a professor and a lobbyist at the same time.
Okay. At Trent University, which I'm sure is a great school. I don't mean anything bad about Trent. Just she's not here, so it's not my problem. But this is kind of a related question that somebody asked, and I think it's a really deep question. I remember I asked this to Brian Ward at the end of his talk, and it kind of bothers me. I see all this pseudoscience stuff, and I figure it's our job, you know, as scientists to address it and tell people this is all bogus. But here's somebody put this, which is one of the things that bugs me. Are most studies showing harmful effects just poorly designed, or is the data itself faked? Are they fooling themselves, or are they honest people?
Well, it's a pretty deep question, and there's a lot of different aspects to this. There clearly has been some fraud, and I mentioned one of the glaring examples of that on this DNA breakage business. But another thing about the data is that there was a study done looking at all these positive, you know, studies that seemed to show problems versus the ones that didn't, and they found evidence for what's called called publication bias. So if you're a scientist and you do a couple of quick experiments and you find an effect, you say, oh my God, this is something noteworthy, so you rush to publish it. But you haven't done, you know, a lot of data, you haven't done an in-depth, you've just quickly done a few things, found something, or you think you found something, so you rush to publish it. Whereas if you didn't find anything, it's such a quick thing, you don't publish it. Because you figure it's not worthwhile. So when they analyzed studies that had supposedly found effects, they found a large percentage of them were studies with very small sample sizes. And that the negative studies were all ones that had been done with large sample sizes and much more rigorous controls. And so don't know if that answers the question, but...
That's good. I think you're right. It's partly people fool themselves and partly partly people are weasels. Some people are weasels. Yeah. So here's a... Ariel. You're supposed to write it down, man. What do you want to say?
Something that I wanted to mention last lecture is that science is being just human. There is something that is called wishful science and pathological science. Scientists become so convinced of their theory is that they fit the experimental evidence to the theory rather than going the other way around. And that's what happened in many of the studies. The scientists actually are convinced that they are correct. So it's not fake in that sense. It's just wishful science.
Here's an interesting question that I'm curious about myself. I don't know if you know the answer, Lauren or Ariel, or I don't know it. In microwave ovens, this is something I've wondered about myself. Is there harm to heating food in a plastic dish in the microwave oven covered by plastic wrap? Are chemicals leached into the food when you heat it up?
Well, probably want to have Joe for that one. He knows more about plastic than I do, but it's not something that I would recommend. I'd say you should use microwave-designed cookware. Okay.
Yeah, it might outgas something from it, I think, if it's hot enough. I think there's some very interesting questions, but they're similar to the ones I asked. So then I'm afraid there's only time for one last question for Mini Science Series 2010. I hope it's a good one because it's mine. I was wondering about noise and power lines. I mean, there is noise in the background of power lines, and it is increasing because of power supplies, switching power supplies and Class D power supplies. This is related to what somebody asked. Might those things have some influence on medical technologies where you need to pull power and you have to have very clean power for looking after people's health in hospitals? Or
I would think that most medical equipment is designed to handle fairly uneven power sources or whatever. It has to pass some pretty rigorous things, but people like Hydro-Quebec, the utilities, are concerned about this because these modern types of power supplies that you mentioned cause certain kinds of distortions in the balance of the loads that they need to in order to deliver power reliably, and so there are various ways they try to compensate for that, but it is an issue that they worry about.
Okay, before we thank Lauren, I'd like to thank everyone here, the best dressed, best looking, smartest people we've ever had for a mini science series. If you enjoyed the series, I'm sorry about the room, by the way. It's the best room we could get for the last few lectures, and I realize it's a little too hot, and I'm hot, and you guys are hot too. In the fall, I believe in the second week to third week of October, we'll be running the symposium that Lauren sponsors on public outreach and public debates in science. And we'll be flying in four top scientists from around the world to talk about pseudoscience and skepticism. I hope to see you all there. And with that, we thank Lauren again and all the other speakers and the hardworking volunteers here.